Columbus Day or the designated Columbus Day. Now, right? Yeah. The 12th is the official. That's Columbus Day when you and I were growing up.
Sure. Correct?
Now, government wants the three-day weekend, so they put it on today.
The government.
It is 8:11 at WEOL. Well, either way, we are joined on the line this morning by author, award-winning author Newton Froelich. He's written the Shakespeare Mask, a novel, as well as the one we'll talk about today, 1492, a novel of Christopher Columbus, the Spanish Inquisition, and a world at the turning point. Newton, thanks for coming on the program. Appreciate it. Thank you.
You're entirely welcome.
So you are going to help separate some of the myths from facts surrounding Christopher Columbus. It says here you spent 8 years in Israel, Spain, and Italy researching and learning about Columbus. What did
I did. I delved into the Inquisition records and in the workbooks and geography textbooks of Columbus and the history surrounding how he raised the money and who put up the money. And it's all in the book.
I guess we can understand Spain and Italy. Why Israel?
Because Columbus came from a Jewish family that fled Spain in the 1400s and found refuge in Genoa. And while he was living there, the family was nominally Christian, but he was very loyal to his Jewish roots. You can see it in his writings and his workbook. And therefore, I went into the records and consulted with an expert in Israel on the Inquisition records. Now, understand this. At the time, he then went to Spain to try to get political and financial backing for his voyage. He was, after all, just a sailor, not a politician or a rich man. He walked into a cauldron of trouble. Spain was at war, Christians fighting Muslims. Half of the country was under Muslim control and half under Christian control, and had been that way for almost 700 years. And so, and to raise money for the war against the Muslims, the king and queen used an old process called the Inquisition of the Catholic Church to go after Jews who had converted to Christianity to see how sincere their conversion was, but more precisely, to find flaws in that conversion so that they could then kill them and take their property. Into this mess he went with his little five-year-old boy, whom he left at a convent in La Rábida that I visited, and then with introductions from the priests at the convent, he found other conversos like him, who one of whom put up the money for the voyage and made a deal with the queen. If he discovers America, you can pay me back, or if he discovers anything worth value. But if he doesn't, this is my money that I put up in. It's 1,700,000 maravedis. Consider that a gift. I just ask for one thing. My nephew assassinated an inquisitor. Please spare him and the rest of our family that was heading for to be burnt at the stake. And in the end, when Columbus discovered America, his first letter I found in the New York Public Library was to the man who put up the money, Luis de Santangel, the great banker in Barcelona. And he didn't have that much success with the boy that executed the inquisitor. He was executed, but the rest of the Santangel family was spared. So that's, in a nutshell, the little story that goes around a big event. It wasn't a fairy tale. The queen didn't pawn her jewels and give him the money. Although after he made his discovery, the queen and he became very close. Columbus was very engaging, a tall, red-headed, handsome fellow. And he lived on in Spain, became admiral of the ocean sea, and lived for years till he died with his Jewish mistress. He couldn't marry her for fear of the Inquisition catching him. and they had a child whom they named after the king, Fernando.
Where did a lot of the myths that we think of Columbus, or maybe the short fairy tale, as you might want to call it, come from? Did you discover much of that in your research?
Well, you know, myths are funny things. They're very hard to, they, as you can see from spins on the social media or on television or even in debates, people say things. And if you say them enough, they happen. I really couldn't tell you how the myth of the pawn jewels came, but I can only tell you this. After the book came out, I got a phone call from the editor of the National Catholic Reporter. And he said, I just want to tell you and thank you for writing your book. It had to be said, and it's a long time in saying. And I had this told to me by the priest that was in charge of the Biblioteca Colombina, the Columbus Library in the Cathedral of Seville. He brought me Columbus's books, and he said, do you know who he was? And do you know the real story? I said, I think I do, sir, Father. He said, good. He said, because you know what Santayana said. He's the great philosopher. Santayana said, those who don't know history are condemned to repeat it. And so, well, look, you have myths, for example, in my last book on the Shakespeare mask. The man who wrote Shakespeare, the Earl of Oxford, not the fellow from Stratford, he was the front man. The man who wrote it was very close with Queen Elizabeth. They shared the same bed together. She was known as the Virgin Queen, but we know of at least four long affairs that she had with one man who had the adjoining room with her in the palace, and they lived like husband and wife for many years. And yet she's steadfastly called the Virgin Queen. Why? Because England had left the Catholic Church, and the people sorely missed somebody like Mary. So she stepped in with a nice spin from her prime minister and became the Virgin Queen.
Newton.
You get that? I'm sure you could come up with a dozen myths that we have about if you look at the myth, I'm doing a new book now on the American Revolution, and the whole story of Washington's throwing things across the Potomac, and, you know, it just goes on and on. People need them. You know, life's a pretty hard place, and nice, sweet-smelling myths help us get through it. They don't make us feel, they don't educate us, that's for sure.
Well, Newton, do we know why Christopher Columbus wanted to go to the New World?
Yeah, we do. The riches in his contract with the king and queen, it's in writing. It's one of the best contracts, and I practiced law for many years in Washington. He got 12.5% of the New World, plus 12.5% of all the trade with the New World. And what was the trick that he had? He discovered the winds, the trade routes. Everybody knew the world was round. Only stupid people thought it was flat. That's another myth. The people knew the world was round. They knew it was 10,000 to 12,000 miles to get to China and India if you sailed due west out of Europe. But they couldn't get there when they went directly because the wind blows straight in your face. But he discovered on merchant voyages that he'd taken down the coast of Africa, that if you go down the coast of Africa a little bit, all of a sudden the winds start to blow west. They're not in your face anymore. So he said to himself, I'll sail out of Spain, go down a little bit to Africa, turn right, get the winds in my back, go to China and India, and then when I want to come back, I'll sail north a little bit, catch those winds that are blowing in the face of Europe, and get them at my back and sail home. And that's it. That little circuitous route is what everybody takes today, and he discovered it.
The book is 1492, a novel of Christopher Columbus, the Spanish Inquisition, and a world at the turning point. We're talking this morning with its author, Newton Froelich. What can you tell us about the personality of Christopher Columbus, or he as a man? Just so
well,
we get an insight into that.
When you read his, he wrote a lot. After the first voyage, he went on three more, and he used those voyages to write a lot of letters to the Queen, by the way. They became pen pals. But he wrote a lot. He kept a journal. He began to think of himself as a prophet, and he was in many ways. He got inundated with rich conquistadors, these rich sons of wealthy men who were looking for gold on his voyages. But he was pretty much a simple sailor who thought about big things, about the world, how it could be better, and how he could settle the area more. These people that were with him, the rich boys, weren't interested in settling. They were just interested in making a buck out of him and enslaving the Indians and digging for gold and whatnot. And he couldn't control them. They had a lot of political and economic power. But he was a kind of a nice guy. Actually, when the book first came out many years ago, it's now being reissued, by the way, because Spain and Portugal last year passed laws apologizing to the Jews that they had tortured and killed and expelled during the Inquisition, and giving their descendants the right to request citizenship in Spain and Portugal and come in return. So I brought it out again. It had been translated into Dutch and Spanish, and it was quite popular. And my agent thought people really ought to understand it more now that these acts of the government came out. But as for him personally, he was a father. He had these two sons, Diego from the first Christian wife in Portugal, and Fernando, the son of the Jews, Beatrice Harania. He had a hell of a time afterwards, because how do you collect 12.5% of North America, South America, and Central America? It was a job, and the government litigated with him and his heirs, believe it or not, for 400 years.
Wow. You mentioned the book has the end part about a world at the turning point. What's taking place in the world that
what do we have in America? That wonderful expression, what goes around comes around. Actually, the more it happens, the more I was kind of intrigued with that title, too. Here we have a fellow going into Spain with Christians and Arabs at each other's throat in a deadly war that went on for 20 years until finally the Christians won in 1492. At the very same time that they signed the contract with him, they won their war and expelled the Jews. It all happened in the same month, January of 1492. But there we have the Christians fighting the Arabs over control of their country and their economic and political future, and the Jews in the middle. Now we have something similar. It began in the 70s with the Arab oil embargo, with the Christian world all of a sudden deprived of oil and standing on lines trying to get to their cars filled up. And there's a war going on. It was called the Yom Kippur War, and Israel was caught in the middle with the Arabs invading. Again, Christians and Muslims fighting for their economic and political survival, and the Jews in the middle. What's interesting is the story again is repeated in an economic sense. Remember, what were the Crusades all about? It was an attempt by the West to get to the spices and the jewels and the silks of the East by crossing the Near East. They first went to Israel, Palestine, and then they try to go, the trade routes take you across Syria and Iraq and so forth. When that became so difficult with perpetual resistance, they started to go around them with sailing voyages around Africa. And they were met on the other side of Africa by the Indian Ocean and the Arab sailing ships. That's why Columbus was looking, and Spain and Portugal, for a route to the east by sailing west. In the same way today, what did we start to do in 1972? Find energy independence. And finally, we've got it. I mean, thanks to fracking and thanks to the natural gas explosion and the beginnings of wind and solar power, we've got energy independence. The same issue, the same challenge that they had back in 1492 and hadn't had faced it but not overcome it except for a minor way in Spain, we've done in a big way in America.
I suppose when you're writing a book, you have to keep your manuscript and the front page of the newspaper separate from each other, or you might start confusing everything because it doesn't seem to be a lot of new things. It seems just to be a repeat of some things that have occurred over time.
Well, you're absolutely right, but that's what Santayana keeps telling us. Anybody that doesn't understand history is condemned to repeat it. And so the big challenge today is, are we going to ignore history and instead repeat it? What are the lessons that we learn? When we study this book like mine, which is really a novel, so it's trying to amuse and entertain as well as educate, what do we learn from it? And from there, how can we make things better now? Do we keep repeating the same phrases and making the same accusations, or do we get smart?
Well, that is the question, and we'll leave it at that. 1492, a novel of Christopher Columbus, the Spanish Inquisition, and a world at the turning point here on this Columbus Day. Thought it'd be a good chance to talk with Newton Froelich. The book is out again, reissued, and we appreciate your time and your insight. Thank you very much for your time this morning, Newton.
Well, thank you very much.